But the mask that was found in Sullivan County, Missouri, in 1879, American Antiquarian, 3-336. It is made of iron and silver. 11. One of the damnedest in our whole Saturnalia of the accursed. Because it is hopeless to try to shake off an excommunication only by saying that we're damned by blacker things than ourselves, and that the damned are those who admit they're of the damned. Inertia and hypnosis are too strong for us. We say that, then we go right on admitting we're of the damned. It is only by being more nearly real that we can sweep away the quasi-things that oppose us. Of course, as a whole, we have considerable amorphousness, but we are thinking now of individual acceptances. Wideness is an aspect of universalness or realness. If our synth essays disregard fewer data than do opposing synth essays, which are often not synth essays at all, but mere consideration of some one circumstance, less widely synthetic things fade away before us. Harmony is an aspect of the universal, by which we mean realness. If we approximate more highly to harmony among the parts of an expression and to all available circumstances of an occurrence, the self-contradictors turn hazy. Solidity is an aspect of realness. We pile them up, and we pile them up, or they pass and pass and pass, things that bulk large as they march by, supporting and solidifying one another. And still, and for regiments to come, hypnosis and inertia rule us. One of the damnedest of our data. In the Scientific American, September 10, 1910, Charles F. Holder writes, "Many years ago, a strange stone resembling a meteorite, fell into the valley of the Yaqui, Mexico, and the sensational story went from one end to the other of the country that a stone bearing human inscriptions had descended to the earth." The bewildering observation here is Mr. Holder's assertion that this stone did fall. It seems to me that he must mean that it fell by dislodgement from a mountainside into a valley, but we shall see that it was such a marked stone that very unlikely would it have been unknown to dwellers in a valley, if it had been reposing upon a mountainside above them. It may have been carelessness, intent may have been to say that a sensational story of a strange stone said to have fallen, etc. This stone was reported by Major Frederick Burnham, of the British Army. Later Major Burnham revisited it, and Mr. Holder accompanied him, their purpose to decipher the inscriptions upon it, if possible. This stone was a brown, igneous rock, its longest axis about 8 feet, and on the eastern face, which had an angle of about 45 degrees, was the deep-cut inscription. Mr. Holder says that he recognized familiar Mayan symbols in the inscription. His method was the usual method by which anything can be identified as anything else, that is to pick out whatever is agreeable and disregard the rest. He says that he has demonstrated that most of the symbols are Mayan. One of our intermediatist pseudo-principles is that any way of demonstrating anything is just as good a way of demonstrating anything else. By Mr. Holder's method we could demonstrate that we're Mayan if that should be a source of pride to us. One of the characters upon this stone is a circle within a circle. Similar character found by Mr. Holder is a Mayan manuscript. There are two 6S. 6S can be found in Mayan manuscripts. A double scroll. There are dots and there are dashes. Well, then, we, in turn, disregard the circle within a circle and the double scroll and emphasize that 6S occur in this book, and that dots are plentiful, and would be more plentiful if it were customary to use the small I for the first personal pronoun, that when it comes to dashes that's demonstrated, we're Mayan. I suppose the tendency is to feel that we're sneering at some valuable archaeologic work, and that Mr. Holder did make a veritable identification. He writes, "I submitted the photographs to the Field Museum and the Smithsonian and one or two others, and, to my surprise, the reply was that they could make nothing out of it. Our indefinite acceptance, by preponderance of three or four groups of museum experts against one person, is that a stone bearing inscriptions unassimilable with any known language upon this earth, is said to have fallen from the sky." Another poor wretch of an outcast belonging here is noted in the Scientific American, 48-261, that, of an object, or a meteorite, that fell February 16, 1883, near Brescia, Italy, A false report was circulated that one of the fragments bore the impress of a hand. That's all that is findable by me upon this mere gasp of a thing. Intermediatistically, my acceptance is that, though in the course of human history, there have been some notable approximations, there never has been a real liar, that he could not survive in intermediateness, where everything merges away or has its pseudo-base in something else would be instantly translated to the negative absolute. So my acceptance is that, though curtly dismissed, there was something to base upon in this report, that there were unusual markings upon this object. Of course that is not to jump to the conclusion that they were cuneiform characters that looked like fingerprints. Altogether, I think that in some of our past expressions, we must have been very efficient, if the experience of Mr. Simons be typical, so indefinite are we becoming here. Just here we are interested in many things that have been found, especially in the United States, which speak of a civilization, or of many civilizations not indigenous to this earth. One trouble is in trying to decide whether they fell here from the sky, or were left behind by visitors from other worlds. We have a notion that there have been disasters aloft, and that coins have dropped here, that inhabitants of this earth found them or saw them fall, and then made coins imitatively. It may be that coins were showered here by something of a tutelary nature that undertook to advance us from the stage of barter to the use of a medium. If coins should be identified as Roman coins, we've had so much experience with identifications that we know a phantom when we see one, but, even so, how could Roman coins have got to North America far in the interior of North America or buried under the accumulation of centuries of soil unless they did drop from wherever the first Romans came from? Ignatius Donnelly, in Atlantis, gives a list of objects that have been found in mounds that are supposed to antedate all European influence in America, lathe-made articles, such as traders from somewhere would supply to savages marks of the lathe said to be unmistakable. Said to be, of course we can't accept that anything is unmistakable. In the report. Smithson. Inst. I-881-619, there is an account, by Charles C. Jones, of two silver crosses that were found in Georgia. They are skillfully made, highly ornamented crosses, but are not conventional crucifixes, all arms of equal length. Mr. Jones is a good positivist that De Soto had halted at the precise spot where these crosses were found. But the spirit of negativeness that lurks in all things said to be precise shows itself in that upon one of these crosses in an inscription that has no meaning in Spanish or any other known terrestrial language. Incasiju, according to Mr. Jones. He thinks that this is a name, and that there is an aboriginal ring to it, though I should say, myself, that he was thinking of the far distant Incas, that the Spanish donor cut on the cross the name of an Indian to whom it was presented. But we look at the inscription ourselves and see that the letters said to be C and D are turned the wrong way, and that the letter said to be K is not only turned the wrong way, but is upside down. It is difficult to accept that the remarkable, the very extensive, copper mines in the region of Lake Superior were ever the works of American Aborigines. Despite the astonishing extent of these mines, nothing has ever been found to indicate that the region was ever inhabited by permanent dwellers. Not a vestige of a dwelling, a skeleton, or a bone has been found. The Indians have no traditions relating to the mines. America Antiquarian, 25-258. I think that we've had visitors, that they have come here for copper, for instance. As to other relics of them, but we now come upon frequency of a merger that has not so often appeared before. Fraudulency. Hair called real hair, then there are wigs. Teeth called real teeth, then there are false teeth. Official money, counterfeit money. It's the bane of psychic research. If there be psychic phenomena, there must be fraudulent psychic phenomena. So desperate is the situation here that Carrington argues that, even if Palladino be caught cheating, that is not to say that all her phenomena are fraudulent. My own version is, that nothing indicates anything, in a positive sense, because, in a positive sense, there is nothing to be indicated. Everything that is called true must merge away indistinguishably into something called false. Both are expressions of the same underlying quasiness, and are continuous. Fraudulent antiquarian relics are very common, but they are not more common than are fraudulent paintings. W.S. Forrest, Historical Sketches of Norfolk, Virginia. That, in September, 1833, when some workmen, near Norfolk, were boring for water, a coin was drawn up from a depth of about 30 feet. It was about the size of an English shilling, but oval, an oval disc, if not a coin. The figures upon it were distinct, and represented a warrior or hunter and other characters, apparently of Roman origin. The means of exclusion would probably be men digging a hole, no one else looking, one of them drops a coin into the hole. As to where he got a strange coin, remarkable in shape, even that's disregarded. Up comes the coin, expressions of astonishment from the evil one who had dropped it.